Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, where we catch you up on the political news of actually the last 2 weeks and preview the week ahead. And we have a lot to catch up on after our hiatus, so let's jump in. We're joined this week by Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen. Welcome back, Marty.
Good morning.
Jeremy Pelzer, political reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Morning. Great to be here.
And Karen Kassler, the bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Happy Monday.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Biden is his party's presumptive nominee, which means he won't be officially official until the Democratic convention in August. Now, if you're asking why that matters, it's because the DNC convention is after Ohio's filing deadline for November, which means Biden doesn't qualify for Ohio's ballot until it's legally too late. Senate President Matt Huffman initially said that sounds like a Democratic problem. But then last week, he said this.
For folks who say, well, we can keep Joe Biden off the ballot, that's wrong. I think you're not going to be able to look at the current president of the United States and a major political candidate and just say, we got a law, you didn't know about it, ha ha.
So, Marty, any chance Biden isn't on Ohio's ballot come November?
Well, I suppose there is one. We've got the Ohio Secretary of State saying that something needs to happen in order for him to be on it. But I think that Huffman is right for a host of reasons, not least of which is we just had a Supreme Court that said in a different context that individual states can't keep candidates off the ballot. In that case, it had to do with disqualifying Donald Trump.
Democrats have a couple of options to get President Biden on the ballot. Karen, can you tell us what a legislative fix would entail?
Well, this has happened twice before. The law that created the 90-day deadline started in, well, it was passed in 2010. It was part of a bill that set up a way to pay bonuses that voters had approved for veterans of the wars in the Persian Gulf, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And so in 2012, both parties had this problem. There was a legislative fix where the 90-day deadline was moved to 60 days. In 2019, in anticipation of 2020, same thing. Both parties' conventions would be affected by this 90-day deadline, so it was moved to 60 days. Whatever the legislature does, it has to happen by May 9th. And what's today, April 22nd? It's
yes.
Not a whole lot of time for the legislature to come together and do something that would move that deadline or in some way change that state law temporarily. Because both of those times, in 2012 and in 2019, the law was changed. It was only for 2012 and 2020.
Yeah, and they could have included it in last year's budget because the Democrats had already announced the date of their convention. So that's what they did in the 2019 budget. They put it in for 2020. Any idea why that didn't happen this time around?
We don't know. The Ohio Democrats have indicated that they've deferred to national Democrats on this the whole time. And so then the question is, why didn't national Democrats do this? And as I talked to David Niven, who is a University of Cincinnati political science professor, and he was joking that some lawyer at the DNC is probably going to be fired over this for missing this. And then the other question, related question, is why doesn't the legislature just move the deadline? If every year they have to pass these exemptions for these candidates just because I'm creating a manufactured problem where there doesn't necessarily otherwise wouldn't be a problem, why don't they just move the deadline? And that's a great question that lawmakers are not really talking about, even after this has come up.
And when Huffman made that comment that you played just a minute ago, he referenced that the 90-day deadline was set because of early voting, because you've got ballots that have to go overseas and military voters and that sort of thing. But 90 days is a long time. And other states that are having similar problems, there are two other states, Alabama and Washington, where there are similar problems. And their deadlines, I think Alabama's maybe 82 days or something like that. Still a long time before the actual fall vote. But that's going to be the question is, I wonder if a permanent solution might involve changing something about early voting, because you do have some Republicans who think 30 days is too long.
Marty, so the state of Washington, which Karen referenced, actually is going to accept a provisional certification, sort of a like an early promise to certify him at the national convention. But Ohio's like, nah, you can't do that here.
Well, there's an important difference between Ohio and Washington, and that is that Washington State is controlled by Democrats and Ohio is controlled by Republican supermajorities. And you know I hate to be the cynic, but I wonder whether politics is playing a role in this.
You know, sometimes I wonder if these laws are a little bit of holdovers from when conventions actually mattered, when parties actually chose their candidates at the conventions. Like, because now they're kind of an afterthought, right? We already know who the nominees are.
And that's why some of this is so silly, because we've known for, what, months now that Donald Trump and Joe Biden are the two nominees, whether you like that or not. And so it is interesting to have this discussion where a state law passed in 2010 could potentially be problematic for the Democratic candidate, the sitting president. But it's really clear that this is something that certainly Huffman and his Republican colleagues, I guess, in the Senate are ready to do something about. The question, I think, is about the timing and whether it's going to happen fast enough.
Yeah. So if the Secretary of State and the Attorney General say you can't file this provisional certification, if the legislature doesn't act by May 9th, Jeremy, what are the other options?
I just read an ABC story that kind of lays out what the Biden campaign's thinking of this, and their top priority, their initial way to respond to this is through, as Marty and Karen said, this provisional certification idea. And if that doesn't work, then they're going to try to pass it. And I'm talking about both in Alabama, Ohio, and in Washington State. So if that provisional idea doesn't work, they're going to go to the state legislature. If the state legislature doesn't do it, they're going to go to court. And Matt Huffman has actually indicated that he thinks it's a really good chance that the court is going to allow Biden on the ballot, for the same reason that Colorado recently ruled, or I'm sorry, that the U.S. Supreme Court recently ruled that Colorado had to allow Donald Trump on the primary ballot, which is basically that federal election law controls federal elections and state officials can't interfere with that. So if that lawsuit doesn't work, then let's say the Democrats tried three things and then all of them didn't work. The final idea that they had was to hold a Zoom meeting.
Oh, like
basically,
a mini online convention.
To have a Zoom mini convention online where they make Biden the nominee. And that would satisfy Ohio law.
Oh, so it's kind of like when you do the courthouse wedding, but then you do the big party at a later date.
Yeah. You fill out the administrative paperwork and then you have the big wedding later.
I'd like to move on to discussing the death of former PUCO chairman Sam Randazzo. But first, this segment is going to include a discussion of suicide. If you or someone you know needs help, the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline in the U.S. is available by calling or texting 988. There's also an online chat at 988lifeline.org. Marty, can you walk us through the charges that Randazzo was facing?
Well, he's facing charges in two different venues. He's was charged in federal court, and then earlier this year, he faced state charges. The federal charges have to do with this $4.3 million payment he received from First Energy just as Mike DeWine was picking him to regulate First Energy. And then he proceeded to do a lot of favors for First Energy, extremely lucrative ones. He helped author and lobby for House Bill 6, a $1.3 billion bailout First Energy received. He also killed a rate case which benefited that was scheduled for this year that benefited First Energy stock price, et cetera. And then in state court, his charges detail a pattern of behavior going back to 2013 in which he served the industrial energy users of Ohio as general counsel while secretly consulting for First Energy, who he was supposed to be representing the industrial users against. He was accused of siphoning money. All told, he got, I think, pretty well over $10 million from First Energy over the years.
And Jeremy, your outlet found that he also perhaps was taking money from other energy companies further back in his history.
Right. Well, according to prosecutors, he had been involved in helping to arrange these secret deals between utility companies and big energy users, like big like steel mills, ones that companies that use a lot of electricity, where the steel mills and these other companies would, they would try to contest before regulators, they would oppose attempts to raise rates. And so in exchange for dropping that opposition, then Randazzo would negotiate these deals where the utilities and Duke Energy and then later First Energy would pay money or offer a discounted rates to these large energy companies specifically in exchange for dropping their opposition to it.
So, Karen, Sam Randazzo was 74, and if convicted, now I will say up until the day he died, he maintained that he was innocent and that these were legitimate payments. But if convicted of all these charges, both state and federal, it looked like a real possibility that he could have died in prison.
Yeah, I mean, looking at what was ahead, and of course, we have no idea what was going on in his head. But I mean, facing either being in court or in prison for the rest of his life. His assets were all frozen as the case was continuing. He had health problems that he had documented in his attempt to try to get his trial moved from Cincinnati to Columbus. And you have to wonder what kind of support he might have had, because so many of the people who were have been tied to him were also either facing legal charges or probably concerned about that. And so it's I don't want to provide excuses or you know, make someone feel sorry for him or whatever, but these are realities that he was probably facing.
Yeah, and so ultimately he chose to end his own life by suicide earlier this month. And again, if you are having thoughts of suicide or you believe a loved one does, you can call 988 or you can text 988 for help. So what happens now, Marty, because he's the second major player in this House Bill 6 scandal to die by suicide. So where does the case go from here?
Well, he was in state court. He was charged jointly with two top First Energy executives. So that case goes forward. How this changes the case from the prosecutor's point of view, we don't know yet. Obviously, he was charged solely in the federal case, so that goes away. There's nobody to try anymore. And what I'm really interested in is who is going to testify against these First Energy executives, whether Mike DeWine's former chief of staff, Laurel Dawson, is still going to be a witness. I want to know what she knows. There's a lot still to learn.
And Attorney General Dave Yost was at the State of the State and talking to reporters about this and had said that this doesn't change the case. The case still moves forward. And, I mean, it's worth noting that the other person who died by suicide, Neil Clark, died by suicide in March of 2021, and all the arrests happened in the summer of 2020, the case still went forward against Larry Householder and Matt Borges in federal court. So if there's any assumption that this stops any sort of prosecution, well, that's not what happened in the federal case.
And one of the big questions that I think Marty just alluded to earlier is, what did Governor Mike DeWine or the people closest to him know about Sam Randazzo, and when did they know it?
They sure seem to be reluctant to talk about that. You know, Laurel Dawson, Mike DeWine's chief of staff, was her husband at the time Randazzo was being appointed, was a First Energy lobbyist. DeWine's legislative affairs director, Dan McCarthy, came to the administration from being a First Energy lobbyist, where he started Partners for Progress, a dark money group that ended up funneling millions and millions of dollars into this whole scheme. John Husted, the lieutenant governor, we learned that he got a group supporting him got $1 million in First Energy money through dark money contributions. And Husted's office is refusing to even say whether Husted knew about that contribution, which I don't know why anybody would make $1 million contribution to a politician and not make sure the politician knew about the contribution.
So you asked where this is going to go now, Anna, and where the reporting trend has been is towards these First Energy payments. So in addition to the $1 million to that pro-Husted dark money group, there was also $2.5 million that First Energy gave to a Republican Governors Association affiliated dark money group that backed DeWine in 2018. So the trend is following the money towards higher, the highest levels of the governor's administration. And as Marty said, Houston has refused to talk about whether, you know, this, he knew about this and what, if anything, First Energy got with this money. Of course, DeWine was the one who signed House Bill 6. He later signed a partial repeal of it, including the nuclear bailout. But there was strong support for House Bill 6, both among Houston and DeWine, as the corrupt energy law passed in 2019.
And there appears to be still some support for elements of House Bill 6, because everything other than the nuclear power plant subsidies still remains, including subsidies for two coal-fired power plants and also the changes in rules on renewable energy standards. So there seems to be, and when you talk to Speaker Jason Stevens about this, he says this has all been discussed and we've gone over it, and the law is the law. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of appetite to make any changes. Democrats have pushed for that, but majority Republicans have not.
We should note that one of the power plants that is getting the subsidies, one of the coal plants, is in Jason Stevens' district.
And the other one's in Indiana. But one thing I'd add, too, is that in the later, I guess it was in the sentencing phase of the householder trial, federal prosecutors voiced their amazement that any piece of House Bill 6 remains on the books. But there it is.
Even yeah. Houston himself has said he would like a full repeal of House Bill 6.
Yeah, House Minority Leader Alison Russo has called it an environment that's ripe for another corruption scandal. So,
well, and I think that relates to there have been really no changes on campaign finance laws and transparency and dark money. And I don't know what can be done at the state level, because a lot of that is related to, you know, Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court and everything. But it's not just House Bill 6 remaining, but it's the idea that other laws that could have changed that may have made it less likely for something like that to happen have not changed.
Other states have laws that require disclosure of dark money. There needs to be. And in fact, when Citizens United itself was handed down, some of the justices, I believe it was Rehnquist, said that sunlight is the best disinfectant. It's okay for businesses to participate in politics, but people need to know the sources of the money.
That's one of the biggest takeaways of this scandal that doesn't get talked about nearly enough, which is the reason the House Bill 6 scandal was allowed to take place is because of these dark money groups that operate without any real transparency. My colleague Andrew Tobias, back in 2018, the group that got the pro-Houston group that got $1 million from First Energy, he tried to track them down. He found their tax filings, called the number and the name on the tax filing, and this woman in Texas answered the phone. It's like, what are you talking about? I don't know who these people are. So it's a completely opaque group, and you can have these dark money groups. You can have political spending, and money can equals free speech, but you can have transparency that actually allows people to not hide behind, in this case, just completely made up and information.
Yeah, they always have great names, these PACs, these dark money PACs. It's always like Ohioans for a freer freedom.
Ohioans for an Ohioer or something, yeah.
One last thing on this. I don't want to drag it out too much, but the DeWine administration now is saying that everybody knew about Sam Randazzo's connections to First Energy at the time Randazzo was getting this $4.3 million payment and DeWine was making him PUCO chief. But the fact is, it was not well known at all, and Randazzo and First Energy went to pretty great lengths to keep all that secret. So that's another question that we're all going to keep asking the DeWine administration, I'm sure.
I can remember when he referenced that in a press conference, and a lot of reporters were like, what? He was? We didn't know that. But it should be stated, too, that it's not just Republicans that use dark money. Democrats do, too. But in this particular case, everybody – I mean, you look at Larry Householder, the former Speaker, a Republican, former Republican Party Chair Matt Borges. I mean, it should be said, though, that both parties do use the protections offered by dark money.
Coming up, we're analyzing the court ruling that blocked a ban on prescribing hormones for transgender minors and whether the law will be put on hold indefinitely. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. And still with us is Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen. Cleveland.com reporter Jeremy Pelzer.
Hi.
And Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Hello.
So transgender teens, we're going to have to stop taking puberty blockers and hormones here in the state of Ohio or leave. That's until a judge blocked House Bill 68 from becoming law this week. The judge issued a temporary injunction pausing the law for 2 weeks. Karen, what happens next?
More litigation. I mean, if you look at the trajectory that other situations have had, I mean, abortion legislation, things that have been sued over, there's going to be a hearing. There will likely be a decision. Then there will be appeals. And so I would expect that this eventually gets to the Ohio Supreme Court. And looking at what's happened in other states, too, this is the same kind of situation that, I mean, it's I don't even know how many states have gone through this now. And so the suggestion, I think, has been that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to have to weigh in on this in some way. So it's just more litigation.
Marty, what I find really interesting is the judge who put this temporary injunction in place actually talked about this being the perfect case for single subject.
You know, that's
which is a nerdy topic, but it's like it is for like State House reporters. It's really interesting.
And single subject rules mean that you can't put everything, including the kitchen sink, into a bill. You have to have it has to have a single subject. And the idea that and generally, I think that's been invoked for people to try to stop far reaching, quote unquote, big government legislation. And the idea that it's being invoked here does involve a certain amount of irony.
Well, and there's been, I mean, I can't think of a time that that's been even successful on the first round. I mean, it's just, it's like Marty said, it's brought up a lot in litigation, but it's, I just really would have a hard time thinking that that's going to be the thing that pushes this forward, not some of the other issues involved, but who knows?
Yeah, the argument here is that it was literally two separate bills. So House Bill 68 originally dealt with hormone therapy, puberty blockers, surgery for transgender minors. And then there was this other bill that dealt with whether transgender girls could play on female sports teams. And then the two bills became one bill that passed. And I thought it was really interesting that the judge was like, I actually don't know if you could have passed one without the other. And maybe that makes it a violation of single subject. But who knows where that specific argument will go.
Well, just something I wanted to point out, because the people who support these kinds of bills, they say they're protecting these young people. And I just looked up some stats. 80% of transgender people have had suicidal ideation at some point in their life. 40% actually attempt it. I wonder whether, you know, they're taking those concerns properly into account as they do these sorts of things.
And, Jeremy, there actually is a restriction on transgender access to certain types of interventions that it will go into effect in May. The governor had an executive order dealing with surgery, right?
And not only that, this legislative board just waved forward some rules about implementing this. Governor DeWine, even though he vetoed House Bill 68, said, well, we still need some rules about this. And so he's putting forward these lesser rules limiting the ability of minors to get access to surgery. Like the main Republican argument against this is, well, you're letting kids make these life-altering decisions when they're still young, and the insinuation is they're indoctrinated, that they think they're someone of the opposite gender, according to Republicans, and therefore they are indoctrinated and they're going to make a terrible mistake and have a life-altering surgery, and that is why they oppose this. They basically equate it to some form of child abuse.
But yet they're minors, so parental choice is part of this because, I mean, any parent will tell you that their children, if they're going through a medical procedure, the parent has to sign off, at least one parent. So it's interesting to hear the arguments about parental choice and the role that parents should have in education and health and all of these things. So that's just something to think about, too.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. And I do agree that there have been a number of similar laws and lawsuits in other states. And ultimately, particularly the transgender sports, because that seems to center around Title IX. I don't see how the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't eventually take up at least that particular aspect of it. Yep. Let's move on to Governor Mike DeWine's annual State of the State. And while these speeches can feel perfunctory, DeWine listed off a bunch of ideas that he'd like to see become law, most of which centered around kids.
The single most important thing we can do for Ohio's future is to ensure that all Ohio children, no matter where they live, no matter who their parents are, have the opportunity to live up to their full God-given potential. And if they have the chance to pursue their dreams and their passions in life, it's the most important thing we can do. Kids have only one chance to grow up, so we must have a great sense of urgency, as every moment we waste is a moment that they lose.
Karen, can you walk us through some of the proposals that the governor has for children?
I thought this was a really interesting speech because so much of it was about kids. I mean, he didn't talk about Intel. He didn't talk about some of the other things that he could have talked about. It was a lot about kids and legislation. For instance, he wants a statewide ban on flavored tobacco, which just late Friday, a Franklin County judge ruled that the ban on flavored tobacco bans.
There we go.
Yes. It's not going to go forward. So cities like Columbus can indeed have their bans on flavored tobacco starting tomorrow. And that was something that came out of the budget that DeWine tried to veto, or DeWine did veto. The legislature overrode him. He also talked about a primary seatbelt law, meaning you can be pulled over for not wearing your seatbelt, not pulled over for something else. And if you're not wearing a seatbelt, you're cited for that. So I thought that those two things were really interesting. And they also seem to be non-starters with certain members of the legislature. I remember looking out at lawmakers when he specifically mentioned the statewide ban on flavored tobacco and seeing just like the chilled response that got. And so those are at least two things that I thought were really interesting that came out of his speech.
Jeremy, he also really put public pressure on Ohio's public colleges and universities to exclusively instruct their teachers in what we call the science of reading. I thought it was interesting. He sort of used his bully pulpit to be like, you need to do this or we're not going to hire your graduates.
Yeah, DeWine's been pushing this for more than a year. He started with the state budget last year, and it's the idea of how you teach kids how to read. And there's been a lot of attention given to the type of system that you use. There's been a system that actually came out of Ohio State that has been now, I would say, at the very least, severely questioned about how well that it works. And DeWine is trying to put more money toward making sure that teachers around Ohio know the quote-unquote right way to teach kids how to read. And of course, when you have to do that, you have to put up money to make sure they have the training and all that kind of background in order to do that. Overall, I think the governor's speech was fairly conservative, politically conservative, but also conservative in the idea that there weren't a lot of kind of home run moonshots out of this speech. There was mainly safer, lower level issues that either are either things he's going to get or things that he has definitely talked before, like the science of reading, that lawmakers have already devoted a lot of money towards implementing.
One of the other education areas where he took a stand was cell phones in schools.
That was interesting. And my first reaction was, well, yeah, that totally makes sense. The last thing kids need is another distraction. But I happened to be in a barroom conversation, shockingly, and somebody brought up, well, what if there's a school shooting? And, you know, that is a point. tragically. You know, gunshots are the leading cause of deaths among children in this country. You know, so maybe if the governor cares that much about children, maybe he'd talk about some what people call common sense gun reform.
He did talk about guns in about a minute of the speech toward the end, but really more about efforts to fund law enforcement and these surges that these
try and get illegal guns off the street.
Yes, exactly. But the cell phone issue comes up again with that parental choice thing, because if as a parent you want your child to have a cell phone in school because of the reason that Marty just mentioned or some other reason.
Well, they don't have payphones in schools anymore. Right, I'm dating myself by saying that. But,
but I mean, that's, I think, an issue here. Speaker Jason Stevens said, hey, schools that want to ban cell phones can do it already. They have that authority. And so he didn't necessarily feel that there was a need for any sort of statewide action. Matt Huffman, the Senate president, says he thinks it's a great idea. But this also comes up against the concerns about social media. We saw, DeWine talked about that in the State of the State as well. In the budget, there was a provision about requiring kids under 16 to get parental permission to use social media platforms. That is currently on hold because of litigation. But to move forward on something like that, you know, once again, the question is parental choice versus the harm that maybe all this is doing to kids, something to discuss.
And this has escalated pretty quickly. Even last month, DeWine said he wasn't really pushing for a statewide law to limit cell phone use, that he would leave it to individual school districts to decide. But then he's heard from a lot of educators who have said, well, we put cell phone restrictions, either they have to put it into a special pouch that you can't access your phone during the day, or you have to keep it in your backpack, something like that. And as a result, they were saying, well, you know, our lunchrooms are suddenly abuzz with activity again, and kids are actually talking to each other and doing social interactions that are so important, that if you're of that age, that you're not just looking at your phone, that you're actually talking to other kids.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're analyzing the settlement between Norfolk Southern and the people of East Palestine. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, where we catch you up on all the news coming out of the Ohio Statehouse. Still with us is Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen, Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer, and Karen Kassler, the bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Norfolk Southern says it will pay $600 million to settle the East Palestine derailment lawsuit. Resident and community activist Misty Allison, who is not a party to the lawsuit, told NPR last week that Norfolk Southern has been active in her community since the derailment, but she believes the settlement is not enough.
My stance on this has always been that I'm a firm believer that if you don't have your health, you don't have anything. And, you know, many people say that the East Palestine, Ohio train derailment and what happened in our community is really the largest chemical disaster in United States history. And the long-term health effects of these chemicals are going to have on residents like my family, not to mention the first responders who inhaled that toxic smoke for hours without knowing the deadly chemicals they were breathing. It is still widely unknown. So instead of throwing money at the issue, I am really focused on the long-term healthcare monitoring and the healthcare coverage, and that has still yet to be addressed.
Marty, I think that's one of the most complicated things about a cleanup like this, right? Like, obviously money helps, but, you know, the big question is who will be there to help them 20 years from now if they're you know, feeling the effects of chemicals from 2023.
Right. And adding to the whole mess is the difficulty of proving causality. You know, you have a cancer cluster, but is it due to this or that? You know, and so I think from the Norfolk Southern perspective, I understand why she's concerned about her health and her neighbors, but for Norfolk Southern, this needs to be enough of a financial hit that they have an incentive to not have this happen again, to be safer. But you still have these health concerns going into the future.
Yeah, and I will say that the rail safety bill, the bipartisan rail safety bill that was proposed by Ohio Senators J.D. Vance and Sherrod Brown, is still stuck in Congress. So we will wait to see if there's any federal reform in the future.
I should add, too, that this doesn't end litigation over East Palestine. Not all of the residents of East Palestine signed up or joined this lawsuit, and many residents don't have to accept the settlement money.
Misty Allen, who we just heard from, yeah, she's not a party to that lawsuit.
So, like, this is not the end. This doesn't neatly tie a bow on all litigation regarding this. This just is an attempt by Norfolk Southern to just resolve the majority of claims against the people of East Palestine.
I want to circle back to Franklin County and the race for our county prosecutor. The Franklin County GOP has revoked its endorsement of John Rutan, who is running for county prosecutor in the November election. This comes after a series of strange comments and emails that Rutan sent to the Columbus Dispatch. Among them, he alleged that 9/11 was an inside job, that Franklin County isn't as democratic as it seems, that elections are essentially stolen by Democrats, and that former President Donald Trump, is somehow in collusion with Democrats and other elites in the big state. So in light of all that, it sounds like the Franklin County GOP was like, no.
I think so. And I wonder, we were just at break speculating about this, to what extent that's due to the other false conspiracies he peddled or whether that's due to his criticisms of Donald Trump, because unfortunately some on the right, I guess it's true to an extent on the left too, but it particularly mainstreamed on the right now are a lot of conspiracy theories that are complete nonsense. They there's no evidence to back them up, but people believe them.
And there are Republican candidates who are major party candidates. I mean, Carrie Lake in Arizona, that's just one example where Republicans have nominated through the primary system people who have said all sorts of just really wild stuff. And of course, you've got Robert Kennedy Jr. out there saying all sorts of really wild stuff, too, though he is not a major party candidate. But I think this is part of what we're seeing as a result of some of these things becoming mainstreamed, some of these conspiracy theories and outlandish ideas becoming mainstreamed, and parties are having to accept that our nominee has said these things. And it's many of these things are unproven. They're just simply not true. But how do you disabuse people of that when their party candidates are saying this?
And important to note, too, a good bit of it is straight up Russian propaganda.
The other thing to note, though, is that unlike Carrie Lake, the comments that John Rutan made were also against Trump and Republicans. And that at the Franklin County Republican meeting, that seemed to be the issue that people in the crowd seemed to take the most issue with. He called Trump, quote, a Trojan horse for the Democratic Party. And then he questioned the sanctity of Franklin County elections, and Republicans on the elections board said, no. So these are the theories that he is peddling are also against Republicans, and that was really what especially drew the ire of Franklin County Republicans, not surprisingly at all.
Yeah, it is unusual for a political party to revoke an endorsement. You usually got to do something pretty outlandish to get it taken
isn't
back.
This?
Yeah,
I mean, I'm just, and this is how wild it's gotten, that now you've got Republicans accusing Trump of things. I mean, this is how the rabbit hole diving has gotten into the party, and it's really concerning, I think, for moderate Republicans who are still out there who say, this is not my party. This is not why I became a Republican. I think they're seriously concerned about this.
It's also a sign of how Democrats now completely control Franklin County government. I don't think right now there are any Republican office holders in the entire county since the county engineer stepped down. And therefore, Republicans have to, they have a very limited pool of options to find people to run for these offices.
And you'd probably need a moderate in Franklin County.
Not only a moderate, just someone who's qualified. And obviously, county engineer, there's additional qualifications, but someone like county prosecutor, someone who actually it would make a good county prosecutor. And a Republican is harder and harder to find in Columbus these days who's willing to actually run because they don't really have a chance of winning, at least not a whole lot.
And that's the problem that has been happening on the statewide level, I think, with Democrats.
Yeah.
That Democrats...
building a bench.
Exactly. And you've got to find people, when you talk about nominating moderates, how do you find people who are, say, moderate, but can motivate the base or motivate people to turn out? Because it's all about turnout. And the candidates who can motivate people to turn out are the ones that win.
And I think what we're seeing is things are becoming more and more nationalized. And I think part of that has to do with the loss of local news resources. But also, we're seeing this rural versus urban dynamic. And back to what Karen was saying earlier, I think that, you know, things like Alex Jones, InfoWars, and Breitbart, they just traffic in garbage. And when people become completely untethered from reality, it leads to chaos. And this is what we're seeing.
Let's move on to marijuana. So industry and state officials say that medical marijuana stores could open for adult use customers this summer, potentially as early as June or July. And that is a much faster timeline than we initially thought. So what's changed to allow us to maybe toke up by 4th of July?
Well, my understanding is that there are provisions in the law itself that voters passed overwhelmingly last year that say that these things need to happen by these dates. And the legislature, meanwhile, has dithered. So my understanding is that's what's going to happen. We've got these existing medical dispensaries who are all tooled up. They could just flip a switch almost and do recreational. So I think that's kind of what's happening.
Yeah, the Division of Cannabis Control, which is making all of these rules, has until June 7th to make license applications available. Now, the licenses have to be awarded by September, still technically summer, but I think to Marty's point, he's right, right? That so if you apply for a license June 7th and you're already a medical dispensary, the application process can move pretty quick.
Well, and I think, I don't know about you folks, but my social media over the weekend, when I was looking at it, saw plenty of people who were enjoying their first legal 420. So I think the money that's involved in this may be pushing this forward because certainly voters have approved it. So it's legal now. The only question is, where can you buy it? And people have arguably been buying it for a while
somewhere
now. But
perhaps
now it's just
legal. State up north.
Yes, exactly. And so I think that may be pushing it forward a little bit. But yeah, you've got these dispensaries who are ready to go. The question, of course, is, you know, you have this bill that passed the Senate that made some significant changes in that issue 2 law that voters approved, including changes on where the tax money would go. It increased the tax percentage from 10 to 15%, I think it was. And it cut down on the number of plants that a household could grow. And those changes, if the legislature wants to make those changes, they would presumably need to do that. It's certainly by the end of this particular session. But it's hard when something goes into effect and then you have to come back and say, okay, now we're making these changes to it.
Yeah.
But it's an initiated statute. You can make changes pretty much at any point.
You know, I think maybe something also adding to the pressure for movement is probably the medical dispensaries themselves. Now that recreational is legal in Ohio, you have to pay a fair amount of money to get your, whatever they call it, your authorization.
Your card.
And I'm sure a lot of people are just like, the heck with it. I'm not redoing that thing. It's, you know, and so the dispensaries themselves are probably saying, you gotta give us some certainty here.
And Jeremy, during the State of the State, Governor DeWine again asked lawmakers to clarify rules for public marijuana use. Doesn't look like they're moving on it, though.
It doesn't look like they're moving on it, mainly because the Ohio House, and in particular Speaker Jason Stevens, has resisted moving on that. When the law passed last November, lawmaker or Senate President Matt Huffman and Governor DeWine immediately came out and they're like, okay, well, there's all these law changes we need to make. We need to prevent billboards. We need to prevent people from being able to just walk down the street, you know, into a school smoking a joint and things like that. And Jason Stevens and his allies in the House had said, well, we'll get to that. Well, we need to. We're not going to immediately allow dispensaries to start selling recreational marijuana. And we'll, frankly, they said that they will allow most of those changes to go into effect via administrative rules this fall. And Senate President Matt Huffman told reporters last week he still has a candle out lit for passing marijuana changes by June, because he said some members of the House who he declined to name, some top House members, are secretly with him on this. But it's really been up to Jason Stevens, and he has shown no sign that he wants these to pass very quickly.
We're getting down to the end of our hour together, but I wanted to be able to talk about the privacy rights of dead people. Because the Ohio Supreme Court ruled 5-2 against the Columbus Dispatch and the now retired reporter Randy Ludlow that a database of dead Ohioans with causes of death, along with names and addresses, are protected health information and not a public record. Marty, you and I were there when this was filed. What was it about?
It was about nursing homes. It was during COVID. Randy wanted to know what kind of mortality was happening in nursing homes, so he wanted these aggregated records. And so then the Supreme Court came back, and I actually saw Randy the day that this was handed down, and to say he was gobsmacked by the logic, somehow individual death records are public, but, you know, the aggregated databases where everybody's de-identified are not, again, if one were a cynic, one might think that they're trying to protect people who own nursing homes.
They do have a very powerful and well-funded lobby here in the state of Ohio.
That is correct.
Yeah, that's such a strange ruling, but it is what it is. And now the Supreme Court has spoken on this issue. And Jeremy, you reported that the state could spend millions of dollars to buy some RVs.
Well, since then, I'm a little more skeptical that it will happen. But what the idea was is back in March 14th, as many of your listeners know, there was a series of tornadoes around Indian Lake in Logan County, and hundreds of people lost their homes to that. And they were state and local officials were trying to think, well, how do we get temporary housing for these people? And enter this RV wholesaler from the area who said, well, the state can buy 250 RVs to provide housing for these folks. And then after they don't need the RVs, the state can just resell them or repurpose them. And it would cost about $8 million to do this.
That's not terrible, actually, for 250 RVs.
When you're buying wholesale, you know, it lowers the cost. it seems now, though, that idea, they wanted to move on it pretty quickly. It hasn't moved quickly, which is a sign that people are saying, hold on here, maybe we're going to look at different options. I know John Cross, who's the state representative representing that area, has said, well, we're looking at different options now, and we don't want to get the state into the RV business.
Yeah, I'm resisting the urge to make a Christmas vacation reference here, but no, it's an interesting idea, right? If you have a couple hundred people without homes and you need to very quickly house them after a tornado. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the now infamous FEMA trailers after. Mm. And so it's a question of how do you get them some sort of temporary housing fast?
Not to mention, too, well, the argument for it was, one, they get to stay on their land. So even if you don't have a house, you can have your RV there.
Yeah.
And second, you don't have to relocate your kids, so they don't have to go to a different school, and then that school district loses all the funding because all of a sudden no kids are going to the schools there. So there were a couple arguments. I mean, it wasn't like a total pie in the sky argument. There were some actual arguments to be made for it.
That was Jeremy Pelzer, a politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to Marty Schladen, Ohio Capital Journal reporter.
Thank you, Anna.
And Karen Kassler, the chief of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Hey, it's always great to be here. Thanks.
And I want to say thank you to our All Sides staff, which includes senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, and all of our intern producers who are very shortly leaving us to go home for the summer. Thank you guys so much for your work this semester. And that'll do it for this hour of All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.